Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Enough politics, let's talk about the rebirth of New Orleans music. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, on the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, we'll hear about the unique role that music played in shaping the history of New Orleans, and we'll catch up with clarinetist Dr. Michael White. He had to live in his car and then in a FEMA trailer when Katrina struck. He tells us about the record that resulted from his experiences. Later on the show, what happens when New Orleans jazz travels the world? Israeli bassist and composer Avishai Cohen has one answer. His trio joins us to play his untraditional take on America's quintessential music. All of that on Soundcheck after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Senator John McCain has picked Alaska's first female governor, Sarah Palin, as his running mate. Elizabeth Arnold has details from Anchorage.
Palin entered politics at the age of 32, running for mayor as an outsider against an old boy network she said controlled municipal government. Her first few months were rough, but her youth attracted the attention of the state and national Republican Party. A few years later, as an appointed member of the Oil and Gas Commission, she gathered evidence and passed on ethics complaints against the Republican Party chair, who was doing party business on state time. Her gubernatorial campaign theme, Take a Stand, was a reference to her own stand against the party establishment. Although she was roundly criticized for lacking experience, she defeated longtime incumbent Senator Frank Murkowski in the primary and two-term Governor Tony Knowles in the general election. Once she took office, she put the former governor's personal jet on eBay and stopped construction of a multi-million-dollar road to nowhere from the state capitol. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Anchorage.
Senator Barack Obama and his running mate Joe Biden will spend much of the Labor Day weekend on a bus campaigning through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. They hope to take advantage of the momentum of the Democratic convention that ended last night with a speech to some 84,000 people at Denver's football stadium. Residents along the Gulf Coast are preparing for the possible arrival of Gustav. The system remains a tropical storm, but forecasters say it's likely to strengthen into a hurricane later today over the northwestern Caribbean before reaching Cuba. The National Hurricane Center says on its current track, Gustav will likely arrive in the southern part of the Gulf of Mexico Sunday, where they expect it to further strengthen. European Union countries appear to be backing away from confronting Russia over its attack on Georgia by refusing to enact sanctions against Moscow. Meanwhile, NPR's Moscow correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer reports Georgia is cutting diplomatic ties with Russia.
With Russian troops still occupying Georgian territory in violation of an EU-brokered ceasefire, Tbilisi says it's recalling all of its diplomats from Moscow. The move comes days after Russia recognized the independence of the Georgian separatist regions Abkhazia and South Ossetia to a wave of condemnation from the West. But reports say EU leaders will not enact sanctions against Russia during an emergency summit on Monday to discuss the conflict in Georgia. Earlier, French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner said sanctions and other measures would be considered at the meeting. European diplomats said they were worried about retaliation from Moscow. Russia provides more than a quarter of Europe's natural gas supplies and is the world's second largest oil producer. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 121 points at 11,593. The Nasdaq is down 38 at 2373. This is NPR News.
And this is WNYC New York. 81 degrees and mostly sunny at 2:04. Good afternoon. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson. John McCain's choice of little-known Alaska Governor Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential running mate has local Republicans mulling the implications of a McCain-Palin ticket. In her debut appearance with McCain this afternoon, Palin spoke admiringly of Senator Hillary Clinton's presidential bid. And New York-based political consultant Norm Adler says that points to one of many factors that probably motivated McCain's choice.
I think it's partially an effort to go after disenchanted Hillary voters. It's partially an effort to balance off the fact that the candidate for president is quite aged by picking somebody who's youthful. And since she has zero baggage that we know of, she makes a perfect candidate for vice president.
Adler, who's working on five state Senate campaigns, including that of Majority Leader Dean Skelos, says Palin will rally New York's Republican base. The FAA is backing down for now on a planned auction of a takeoff and landing slot at Newark Airport. The airlines and the Port Authority say the auctions will make flying more expensive and force out smaller planes. And they filed a lawsuit claiming the FAA lacks congressional authority to impose them. Speaking on his WOR radio show today, Mayor Bloomberg says he understands their concern, but he's looking out for New York's interests.
Our economy depends on people being able to get in and out. We want the big planes if we can't have all of them.
The FAA says the auctions would reduce air congestion, but the agency agreed to put them off until an independent FAA office looks into the Port Authority and the airline's complaints. Lehman Brothers is set to lay off over 1,000 employees. It's the fourth round of layoffs this year. The struggling investment bank lost $2.8 billion last quarter because of write-downs of mortgage-related assets, and it's rumored to be shopping around some of its assets in a bid to improve its balance sheets. The layoffs would affect nearly 5% of the bank's workforce.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org.
After Katrina, the music's still marching in and reaching out. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, 3 years after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast and killed almost 2,000 people, we'll look at how New Orleans jazz has endured and how it's been transformed. In a little while, we'll talk to Katrina survivor, clarinetist, and composer Dr. Michael White. And later still, the Avishai Cohen Trio gives us a live, untraditional interpretation of America's quintessential music. But first, it's been said that you can read the history of America through the history of New Orleans, and you can hear the history of New Orleans in its music. So we start today with Ned Sublett, record producer, composer, songwriter, and author of the book The World That Made New Orleans, From Spanish Silver to Congo Square. Ned, welcome back.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here today. It's also a responsibility because this is a very somber day for New Orleanians. To say 829 to a New Orleanian is like saying 9/11.
To a New Yorker, yeah.
It's that heavy. And, you know, people all over the city. If the last 2 years are any indication, people get a little tense around this time of year, and of course we're finding New Orleanians getting ready to evacuate again today.
In the face of another oncoming hurricane. Now, in your book, you talk about how African America took a terrible blow when the collective knowledge of black New Orleans was scattered to the four winds. Dispersing that population was like tearing up an encyclopedia in front of an electric fan. Now, today is the anniversary of Katrina. It's also the day after an African American has accepted the nomination to be president of the United States. Barack Obama referred actually to Katrina once or twice last night. So what is the state of this encyclopedia that's been torn apart in front of the electric fan, to use your metaphor?
It's by no means clear that it's going to come back. You know, we really don't know. It's still a struggle, and the struggle goes on every day. The sort of the cliche of New Orleans now is that Katrina is still going on. The latest numbers I've seen suggest that 63% of the African American community is back. That means 37% of them are still in exile. And of course, you can't be blind to the fact that changes the political balance in Louisiana either. But it's also the community that, you know, from which came Louis Armstrong, Mahalia Jackson, Fats Domino, Lil Wayne. Mm-hmm. It's the core of where that music that attracts the tourists grows out of. And if that community doesn't come back, it's a very tricky situation.
Well, now, this is one of the striking things about your book, The World That Made New Orleans, is how pivotal the role of music is in shaping the history, the culture that is New Orleans. How does music do that in New Orleans to an extent that it doesn't elsewhere?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, to me, music is a way of reading history. You almost everywhere you go. And history is also something that, you know, my first book, which was about Cuba, was a book called Cuba and Its Music, and it was in the music section, but I put a lot of political and cultural history in it. This book, The World That Made New Orleans, is in the history section, but music is the constant reference point. Music's always there in human culture, but especially in New Orleans, the great American music city with its unique population. My basic point of departure for the book is that by the time Louisiana became the 18th state in 1812, New Orleans was already a city we would recognize today. The elements that make it so markedly different, both visually and audibly, from other American cities was already fully in place, and we can see what some of these elements were by looking at the history and kind of unpack the sound of New Orleans a little bit.
Now, you know, we started with this kind of very traditional brass band sounding thing from New Orleans, and I think people recognize that. What they may not recognize are the myriad other musical contributions of the city. The song Good Rockin' Tonight, for example, you kind of put this out there as perhaps the first rock and roll song
ever. A lot of people would argue that. I mean, it's really, you can't say there was such a thing as a first rock and roll song, but Good Rockin' Tonight, which was a jump blues in the then current Louis Jordan style, you know, Good Rockin' Tonight, that it was rocking. They were rocking, but they had been rocking in New Orleans for a long time. My book begins by talking about Congo Square, and I actually just read this one quote. On Sabbath evening, wrote a visitor to New Orleans in 1819, the African slaves meet on the green by the swamp and rock the city with their Congo dances. Rock the city with their Congo dances. New Orleans was the first town that rocked, and that green by the swamp was about a block and a half from where Roy Brown in 1947 recorded Good Rockin' Tonight.
And here is that 1947 recording by Roy Brown. Roy Brown, Good Rockin' Tonight. That was actually recorded near Congo Square in New Orleans, and perhaps the first ever rock and roll record, 1947, as Ned Sublett told us. He's composer, songwriter, author of the book The World That Made New Orleans, From Spanish Silver to Congo Square. And you talked about the unique melting pot, the people who made New Orleans what it is, all of whom brought their own music to bear, obviously. One of the things you focus on, which seems not to have been part of our common understanding of New Orleans, is the Santo Domingans who immigrated in the early years of the 19th century. What was their kind of influence on New Orleans culture?
Right. Well, these people are sometimes referred to as Haitians, but I don't call them that because when they left Saint-Domingue, which was the French name for what became the Republic of Haiti on January 1st, 1804, Haiti didn't exist as such yet. These were people who immigrated from eastern Cuba. They were twice dispossessed. They had fled the bloodbath in Saint-Domingue in 1803. When the French embarked on a genocidal war there and were defeated by black resistance and yellow fever, wound up in eastern Cuba, and then a few years later, 6 years later, became persona non grata in Cuba because of Napoleon's invasion of Spain, wound up emigrating en masse to New Orleans. New Orleans was the place where the San Domingan diaspora wound up, kind of like Miami with Cubans in the present day.
And it was like the Cajuns from Nova Scotia.
Yeah, that was different. But the history of New Orleans is a history of diasporas, for sure. Yeah. And it was about a third black, a third blacks enslaved, a third free people of color, and a third white people, although there were far more women of color than men, and more white men than women of color in that migration. But they just about doubled the size of New Orleans. There were some 10,000 people arriving in New Orleans in 4 months in 1809, 1810, at a time when the size of New Orleans was about 10,000. So they transformed the town. They probably retarded the Americanization of the city by two generations, establishing what we, you know, this Creole community,
right.
Very strongly, basically inventing the professions of journalism and law in Louisiana, and keeping open alongside their part of town, a place where on Sunday Africans gathered, Congo Square, which was alongside the Creole part of town, not the Anglo-American.
And the slaves actually got Sundays off,
yes,
in New Orleans.
As they had in the Spanish days.
So how do we know, do we have any clues as to what the music that these people brought with them might have sounded like?
It's a tantalizing question, but we can start to answer it by looking at the musics of the people who came. A lot of people talk about the French period in New Orleans or the Spanish period, but you could as easily call the French period the Senegambian period.
Because
two-thirds
where
of the people, of the Africans that the French brought were Senegambians, many of them Bambara. There were also people from Dahomey and from one boat of unlucky people from Congo Angola, well, from Cabinda. So, you know, you have beginning of music that's rather like the Senegambian music. Then with the Spanish, they start to bring in a lot more Congos. Then with the Anglo-Americans, they began the interstate slave trade and bring in English-speaking Protestant African-Americans from Virginia and Maryland. Each of these layers changes the music.
Now, this bambula that we're hearing by the mid-19th century pianist and composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk, I mean, is he, with La Bambula, trying to evoke the sounds of the Domingan, the Santo Domingan community in New Orleans?
Well, Louis Moreau Gottschalk, as a toddler, lived on Rampart Street right by Congo Square. He certainly was no stranger to the sound of Congo Square, and Bambula was the dance that they danced at Congo Square. It was a dance that was known in Saint-Domingue and in other places as well. Bambula, it's also a drum. It's also a rhythm, in the way that African words get used to mean all these things. Gottschalk, I mean, of course, we don't really know what his intention was, but I think he was telling us something. I think he was telling us that the tune of Bambula has been identified as an old Saint-Domingan, French song, and the rhythm is the rhythm of the right hand's rhythm known as tango or habanera. This is the rhythm that's been bouncing around the Antilles for centuries. It's the rhythm of reggaeton now. You can do reggaeton right on top of Gottschalk.
All right, let's hear a little bit without the reggaeton accent. This was a pop hit of sorts for Gottschalk in the mid-19th century. La Bambula by Louis Moreau Gottschalk, a very popular figure on the sort of emerging concert scene in the United States in the mid-19th
Gottschalk.
Century.
Gottschalk is the major American musical figure of the 19th century, and it is astounding that we do not give him more space today. It is unbelievable to me that Bambula is not a basic piece expected of all of our freshman piano students in music schools. This is what we came out of.
Mm-hmm.
Gottschalk was the first great American concert pianist. He was arguably the greatest American composer of the 19th century and the first great popular concert attraction, the first superstar on the post-P.T. Barnum concert circuit, on the order of a list in Europe.
Right. And we do know some of his pieces, the banjo, for example, has some currency, but nothing, you're right,
and,
nothing.
And there's his piece Ojos Criollos, Danse right. Cubain, which is very significant, published in 1860, the last antebellum year in New Orleans, when Gottschalk no longer lived in New Orleans. It moves the habanero rhythm to the bass, boom, putin, boom, boom, put, and the right has boom, boom, king, gong, 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 gong. It's, you listen to it, it's ragtime, except it's 35 years before the ragtime boom.
Now, there's so much, as we were saying before, so many different musical traditions. Some of them are actually the result of a coming together of different peoples. And there are many stories as to how the so-called Black Indian tribes, the Mardi Gras Indian tribes, got started. Let me run past you the one that I've heard over the years, which is, you know, black slaves, you know, obviously with very restricted rights as to what they could or couldn't do. Notice that Native Americans and, you know, the progeny of mixed marriages between Native and African Americans had much more in the way of rights. And so they would dress up as Native Americans at Mardi Gras time. And this was their way of kind of, if not being totally emancipated, at least getting a kind of a taste of what it might be like to be a step or two up on the social scale. Does that sound right to you?
I've never heard it put in quite those terms. You know, we don't really know the full story of the origin of the Mardi Gras Indians. In a way, that's kind of the beauty of it, is you have to simply accept them for what they are. It's a tradition that continues to evolve according to the needs of the community, and that's one of the most fascinating things about it. I think it's the great folkloric jewel of the United States, alive today on the streets of New Orleans. It does, however, go back a long way. The history of black people and Native Americans cooperating for mutual survival in Louisiana goes all the way back to the earliest years of the presence of Africans there, when Indians were the ones who could show them the survival secrets, you know, the herbs, the way to live in this strange new environment. And, you know, the explanation Indians that the Mardi Gras Indians often give is to honor the people who sheltered them in Maranage.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious source of an image was in 1884, 1885, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, when Plains Indians came to town in a big parade, which may have helped them formalize the tradition.
And so we have this very formalistic thing, a ritual every Mardi Gras with all the feathers and the beads and Sugar Boy Crawford's Giacomo in the background. We've been speaking with Ned Sublett. His book is called The World That Made New Orleans, From Spanish Silver to Congo Square. We want to get to Dr. Michael White in a moment, but Ned, it's been great having you here with us in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be on before Dr. Michael White.
This is Soundcheck.
Dog in my head now, head now. I go handy.
Our look at music in New Orleans 3 years after Katrina continues in a moment with clarinetist and composer Dr. Michael White. And coming up a little bit later, a live performance from the innovative Israeli jazz musician, bassist Avishai Cohen. This is Soundcheck.